Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. You've likely heard the term helicopter parent. A new term, snowplow parents, is emerging. These are parents who clear any obstacles in their child's path to success. This term emerged as the allegations of the college admissions bribery scandal came about, where 50 people were charged in fraud to secure students' admissions to colleges. Joining us in studio this morning is social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you all.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
So, all right, we all know parenting is a tough job. And of course, we all want what's best for our children. So aside from breaking the law, I guess the questions we're looking at here is, where do you draw the line, right? I mean, what used to be acceptable as far as helping, interfering, whatever you might want to call that, and what parents do now has shifted a lot.
Sure. Well, you know, the simple answer is two words. It depends where you draw the line. I think the advantage of this scandal of the college admission puts us a highlight on something that we need to observe in ourselves. And that's the way our society works. You know, it's usually an extreme example of something that really shocks us, that gets us to look at the whole process. And I think that's we can take advantage of that, really, and learn a bit from when even part of it seems humorous and shocking. And if we take this college scandal, violates our sense of fairness, gets us angry. So there's a lot of emotions stirred up by this thing. And I think it's a good time to stop and look and see. And where does what defines parenting? Adequate, good parenting. Let's get into it.
Other thoughts?
I think about taking it right back to watching your child learn to walk. It's very painful watching your child learn to walk, because there's no way for a child to learn how to walk without falling. And as a parent, it's so painful. And there's a developmental milestone that you really can't so easily intervene in or prevent pain and hurt. And yet somehow when they get older and we're looking at other kinds of milestones and other kinds of developmental phases, it's hard not to intervene whenever you feel that you can prevent your child from experiencing anguish. And that's a struggle for parenting from the get-go.
That's a good example, too. It's like you want to reach out there and, like, no, catch them, but you can't, right, if you want them to progress in that. And then it's the same thing as they get a little bit older, you know, that first heartbreak or, you know, they didn't get on the team or the choir or the whatever, and you probably hurt more than they do watching them grow through that. But, I mean, that's growing pains, right?
Absolutely. It's life. And failure is definitely part of life. And the snowplow parenting refers to eliminating failure that your child faces. That's an extreme. But we all kind of engage in it in one way or another. But we need to, as I said before, look at the goal of parenting, which if you look at evolution, has to do with encouraging an individual to be sustaining of themselves and of their progeny. And also perhaps taking care of us too, as we fade out. The importance is people are going to have a fulfilling life if they have a good sense of agency, effectiveness, competency. So how do we convey that to our kids, I think, is the challenge. We saw an example on how not to do it and how shameful it is now with some of these actresses or high profile people going to jail, perhaps.
And I was going to say, you know, it's long been a practice donating money to a university or that legacy thing, you know, to try to get your child in, which I don't feel like seems so different than what was happening here, except for, you know, bribery is illegal. But I don't know. And it's interesting that Lori Loughlin, the one parent who her and her husband gave $500,000 to get their two girls in, she's now saying she thought it was a donation that she, you know, so who knows? I mean, that's, I guess, for the courts to decide. And then you've
Mindy, let me interrupt, because there is a difference, and I didn't determine this difference myself, but I saw it in an article. When the big donor parents give money, it does in fact benefit the institution
sure.
and the students with libraries and sports fields and scientific labs and so on, which is a little bit different, well, actually extremely different than bribing a gentleman with $500,000 to get, you know, the daughters to look like they're hockey players or
on the rowing team or whatever.
So there is a difference. I think not to defend either one, but it just who benefits.
Yeah, and I think my thinking of the similarity would be, does the child whose parent makes the big donation, which definitely benefits the school and students, but would that child get in otherwise? I mean, what were their SAT scores? And, you know, I mean, are they in essence buying their way in? I mean, that's sort of my thought on it. But you're right. It does, you know, those big donations do benefit the other students in schools.
I'm going to suggest also another way to look at this. Just yesterday I saw a car that was a sticker on the rear windshield that said, "Yes, it's all about me." Well, I don't think any of us who are mental health professionals would deny that we live in an age of the greatest narcissism in recorded history. And when parents go out of their way to buy an admission to a university or some such thing, I mean, who are they really trying to benefit? Mm-hmm. I think in many cases, and again, this is reflected in some of the literature, you know, for them to be able to go to the next cocktail party and say that their kid got into Yale, it's like they got into Yale, you know, maybe this sounds almost obvious, but I think that so much of this snowplowing is ultimately not only to the child's detriment, but really on an unconscious level, executed for the sake of blowing up the parents' self-esteem and their status in the community. And then now again, I flip back and forth. So we talked about how painful it is to watch your child learning to walk. I can remember just watching an umpire call a strike on my daughter in softball, you know, when she was in middle school, and I'm ready to kill this guy for missing the call.
Right.
You know, so we can all appreciate, anybody who's been a parent can appreciate that there's nothing that stirs you up and causes you to want to rise to challenge somebody than if your child is in some way mistreated or hurt or whatever.
Yeah.
So this is a big societal shift since I think I was raised by parents who were masters in benign neglect. And I think back and I think, I don't remember getting any guidance about where I'm going to go to school. The only thing I wanted to do for my status was go to an out-of-state school.
Me too, Anne.
In the Midwest, it was like that was my status, if I could get into an out-of-state school. So but other than that, the whole idea that there were certain schools and we never visited any schools ahead of time, five kids. And I think so the shift is, to me, very cultural and in recent years. And, you know, as the baby boomers became parents and then, you know, next generation after that, with smaller families, there was great deal more attention to the needs of the children. And they didn't want to, almost anxiously wanting to make sure that everything goes well and everything is laid out for them. Literally, their clothes from their clothes to who they're going to play with and which preschool they're going to go to. It starts really young, but it's really a big shift from
right. I think teachers have a very good eye on that and experience with that. I remember when I went to school, if I got into trouble and there was a call home, there was no call back to the teacher to kind of interrogate the teacher about my misbehavior. I was put on the spot. I think that was a general thing in the community. Teachers didn't get calls from parents protesting how their kids are treated.
Yeah.
And I think that shifted over the years.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I was going to say, this is an interesting statistic, Mark, that you brought up. College admissions have been become more competitive. Number of applicants has doubled since the 1970s, and the growth in number of spots has not kept pace, remaining basically unchanged at the very top schools. So there's a lot of competition to get into these spots. And, you know, I couldn't help but think when this scandal broke, if I were one of these kids and didn't know and found out that my parents had, you know, had somebody else take my SATs or, you know, got me in on some sports thing, am I going, gee, thanks, Mom and Dad? Or am I going, I'm really upset, Mom and Dad, you didn't think I could do this on my own?
Sure.
Right? So, I mean, it has implications on that relationship as well.
Yeah, very. And some of the kids at the scandal didn't know their parents were doing these things. So that's a double whammy, certainly.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, starting young. And I'm thinking, you know, we all want our kids to do well and we want to make them great, you know, independent adults. But sometimes it's tough. It's like, you know, you're telling these kids how great they are. You know, oh, you're so smart. You're so you this, that. But, you know, there's a line there, too, because you don't want to, you know, raise somebody who thinks they're better than the rest of the world, but you want them to be confident and have self-esteem. So there's no playbook for this.
No, there's not.
Exactly.
It's not a right one either.
Yeah, exactly.
And our culture changes and a lot of the definitions change as well over time.
Well, the star concept of what is good parenting evolves. It's always changing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Certainly it's very different now than when we were kids.
Yeah. Well, I think back to the helicopter parents, which I think came about in the 80s maybe, where that was more like, oh, don't fall off the slide. It was more of a physical thing, being careful. And I was thinking back when I was thinking about the show, I thought, when I was a kid, I can remember my brothers and I, playing in the woods in the junked cars. You know, we'd pick up the broken glass. Here's the diamonds. Take me to California. You know, it's like, who would let their kid play in a junk car, right, with all this rust and glass? Yeah. But we just went out and played wherever we wanted to, and the play has changed for kids. Now we have, you know, the play dates, and how many young kids are left unsupervised? Not very many.
I think the helicopter parenting grew out of safety issues, certainly, and crime.
And the perception that your child is more danger than maybe they really are.
Yeah, exactly. And there were some, major stories of tragedies and kidnappings and danger.
Right.
So nowadays, at letting out at school, discharge time, there's traffic jams around school. I don't think it used to be like that.
Yeah, I don't think little kids are allowed to walk home alone anymore. And I don't think little kids, they let them off the bus if you're not there to meet them anymore.
That's right.
Yeah, when we were kids, you know, that it's changed a lot. But safety's also changed a lot since we were kids, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept of snowplow parenting, I mean, we've got this new term for it, but it's likely been around for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, right, especially when you think of parents who have some means, why wouldn't you, you know, if your kid wants to be, you know, a concert pianist, why wouldn't you give them piano lessons and all of the things that would support whatever their dream is? So it's probably been around more in that economic realm than lower income, who would love to do the same.
It possibly may be the two coasts, too, having lived in places such as South Carolina and Ohio. There are the top echelon students who always think and are groomed for the Ivies.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, other places, Clemson might be the Ivy for a lot of students in South Carolina. Or the idea that you went to Ohio State and everybody else in your five generations went to Ohio State, and that is the legacy.
Right.
So I tend to think it might be a little bit more pronounced on the coasts.
Right. Yeah, you got a point there. And probably in Massachusetts, even more pronounced.
Northeast for sure.
Yeah.
The other thing that this issue has kind of raised is sort of this inequality sometimes in punishment. We haven't gone through the court system. We don't know what's going to happen with these folks that have been charged. But there a case that has been brought up with all this happening. Kelly Williams Bowler, who is from Ohio, low income, single mother of color, sent to jail for lying about her address so her kids could go to a better school district. She put her father's address instead of her own. And they actually said we wanted to make an example of her, and they called it stealing an education. How many there are so many parents who do that. You know, of course, why wouldn't you want your kid to go to a better district if you could figure that out somehow?
Especially when it comes to safety and,
yeah.
And a slum versus slum education versus, a suburban one, a safe suburban one.
Yeah.
So, of course.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the example that you gave, Mindy, of the piano. Lessons. So I think that certainly for as long as any of us can remember, sure, if your child was interested in learning how to play the piano or some musical instrument, if you could possibly afford it, you know, you would try to make sure that your child had lessons. But maybe 30, 40 years ago, you know, you'd ask around, you'd find somebody who teaches piano in the mm-hmm. area, and maybe you'd hire them. Well, now I think it's a little different. I mean, first of all, if your child doesn't like the piano teacher, because the piano teacher is maybe a bit harsh or a bit demanding or gives them too much, fire that person. Yeah. Let's find one my kid will like. Or let's drive my kid to Boston and get someone who plays in the BSO, who I can say, well, my child is tutored, being tutored by blah, 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 who, you know, plays in the BSO. It's just, I mean, example we might think of, whether it's, learning to play a musical instrument or something else, it's just taken to a whole different level of intrusion and expense and coddling and massaging and managing. It's like it's really like a parent has become a manager of their child's career.
And a coach.
In a way that just feels unseemly. And
it's so funny you say that, because I did not like my piano teacher because she would not let me play the current pop music. I had to play these old standards that my grandfather liked. And my mother said, no, you're going to take piano lessons. So you're right. I mean, this is the piano teacher we have, and this is the piano teacher you're going to work with.
You know what that leads to is many parents start building their child's resume.
Right.
Right.
And all the choices, you need to show by seventh grade that you have volunteered and done an amazing thing of raising money for the homeless people. And you have to have some talent, hopefully musical, sports talent. So many parents really are looking at, I'm building the resume to get into a good high school if they go in the private route. And then beyond that, always with the goal of getting into an elite school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, talk about you said a minute ago, Jonathan, the child's interest. Mm-hmm. Well, is the child interested in any of this?
Right.
Or is it
right.
just, we have to do this because this is... the way things are done now.
I have a relative who's actually doing it. It drives me crazy because everything is like, well, that activity is not going to get you a scholarship into college. It's like, we're not going to waste our time with that because it's not. And it's like, what about what the kid is interested in doing? The kid's, you know, how about having some fun along the way?
Of course. Now, I think we really need to stop and look at this, our status-driven society, which is just a point you made. And that I think that's at the root of the drive that parents have. Their own status is really a very powerful thing. I don't think it ever used to be like that. Maybe it wasn't, say, in farming communities over the years. The person with the best farm, the best hog, had status. Mm-hmm. Now it seems to be the person with the best credentials, approved upon credentials, the Ivy League credentials. That's where our sense of status in the society comes from, and it's. It can be very destructive.
Yeah, I think it was Heath Ledger who said, you know, you go to an event, a party, whatever, and people say, you know, what do you do? How much do you make? He goes, no one ever says, hey, are you happy?
Yeah, that's right.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about snowplow parents, parents who clear any obstacles in their child's path to success. And with us this morning, social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jonathan, you said something earlier about, you know, the parents, you know, kind of, you know, wanting the status of their child being in, you know, Ivy League school or on, you know, studying with this famous, you know, concert pianist or something. I also wonder if some of it isn't living through your children, you know, more than just the status. But, you know, I always wanted to do that when I was a kid. Mm. And so I'll let my kid do that. Even the kid may be kicking and screaming, going, I don't really want to do that, you know. So there's a little bit of that. But
you see that in sports particularly.
Yes.
Oh, my God. On the you know, whether it's the basketball court or the ball field, parents who seem to be so swept up in this a fantasy, this hope, this dream that their child's going to become a professional, you know, athlete. And I don't even think it's about the money, although that obviously has become very real.
That was their adolescence. They were trying to and either didn't have the talent, didn't have the connect, you know, whatever.
Got injured, so my kid has the talent. Yeah. He can do it, or she can do it. And there's this myth that if we get our kids into these Ivy League schools, they're going to meet all the right people and they're set for life, right?
Well, that is called the elite edge. And many parents will make financial sacrifices to ensure that their children get into the elite schools. But a recent study, a Gallup study of 5,100 graduates found out that only 9% of the graduates said that their school network had been very helpful in the job market. So there is a myth that for those 9%, maybe that's true, but, you know, 91% say that it didn't have any effect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important because that is a belief. They're going to meet the right people. They're going to then move ahead quickly.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think
That's interesting. You know, that that is a myth.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a pretty widely accepted one and motivating one for some of these behaviors.
Right. There's also an interesting poll by the New York Times and Morning Consult that shows parents don't stop handling things for their children as they become adults. Yeah. And that, some of these statistics are a little bit surprising, Mark.
Yeah, they are. First off, 76. This was done by a fairly large sample. I think almost around 1,500 or 1,800 parents, 1,500, and kids that were, or these aren't kids, young adults that are 18 to 28 years of age. The whole sample consisted of 1,500, and most of them were the kids, and 136 were parents. And what they found was that a good three-quarters of the parents reminded their adult children about deadlines that they had to meet while they were in college, some kind of test or get the paper in it by a certain time.
Or call them up. Don't oversleep. You've got a test this morning.
Exactly. Or texted them. Yeah. That's the other new thing. So that's, you know, a really high percentage, you think, of parents being at their kids' shoulder during a college experience. 22% helped them study, and then 16% actually wrote papers, you know, went beyond just helping them or editing. They actually wrote. So it extends the helpless child into the college years. It extends the kind of hands out when you had hands out teaching them to walk, as opposed to you know, they can walk on their own at this point and need to. So I need to fall to see what muscles are exercised to correct and learn from.
There's also
still doing it.
Yeah, this Dr. Madeline Levine, who's a psychologist, she's the author of Teach Your Children Well, Why Values and Coping Skills Matter More Than Grades, Trophies, or Fat Envelopes. I love the title of that book. Mm. But she was talking about that she regularly sees college freshmen who have to come home because they don't have the minimal kinds of adult skills that they need to be in college. And some of the, I mean, I talk about extremes. Some of the examples that given are pretty extreme. Like, you know, one kid who doesn't like sauce on her food, which sounds like something she's had since she was a toddler, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't take it at school because sauce was on everything. I mean, really?
Yeah.
I mean, so a lot. And of course, again, we go back to, you know, parents want the best, and their intentions are likely good. They're wanting, you know, the best for their kids, and they think they're doing a good thing, and maybe not realizing that these so-called advantages are really disadvantages.
Right.
In psychology, it has a term called learned helplessness, which all of us who are professionals here, you know, are familiar with. And, you know, essentially what that refers to is sort of raising a child or a person or creating an environment in which a person essentially learns to not be able to help themselves.
Right.
At the same time, there's a great deal being written now about resilience and what separates a person who's resilient from a person who isn't. A book, The Orchid and the Dandelion, is a book the author of whom was recently, I think, actually interviewed on Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of resilience that seems to be genetically based,
sure.
That we're born with a great deal of that. But, of course, as parents, we also, hopefully, further that. We sort of enable our children to become, we teach our children to become as resilient as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the parent who is snow plowing is doing the opposite. They're mm-hmm. actually stealing from their children any opportunities to experience, to learn how to cope mm-hmm. with frustration,
exactly.
disappointment, heartache, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, they're yeah. teaching helplessness, yeah. More or less.
And I can see, you know, you want to, you know, do what's best, and your child at a young age may come and say, oh, I have this problem. Say, well, here's what you're going to do. Rather
right.
than by maybe going, well, what options do we have? What would you think you'd like to do? And maybe helping them explore possibilities. If you never learn that mm-hmm. as growing up, then when you get to college, you're always going to fall back on, you know, what resource you had as a kid, which would be your parents helping
sure.
you out of whatever situation you're in, right?
Yeah, I remember my training as a psychiatrist, one of the earliest things in terms of learning psychotherapy was not to give advice, mm-hmm. not to spell out the advice.
And that's so hard.
Yeah.
Well, they taught me regarding advice that stupid people don't take it and smart people don't need it.
Yeah, but I was gonna, and with three daughters, you must have been times where you're biting your tongue going, yeah, I don't like that boyfriend. Bite my tongue, right?
Yeah.
Rick is calling from Dartmouth. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning. Hi. I just had a simple question. As far as the economic spread, where do you find this trend in parents to begin? And is it concentrated heavily on any particular economic level? Because I can't see, like, you know, someone on a lower end wouldn't really be able to provide a lot of the economic incentive for their kids, whereas has there ever been any study done as far as economic background on this symptom?
Rick, you bring up a good point. I think it's, as we mentioned, it's probably, you know, more prevalent when you have those resources, but it happens across all economic mm-hmm. levels. I mean, you may not have the money to, you know, buy the coaches or lessons or whatever, but that doesn't mean you might not like this woman who, you know, lied about the school district to get her kids in a different district, or the ones who call up the teachers and go, you know what, my child is not learning in your classroom. I want another teacher, you know. Mm-hmm. So maybe not to the same extreme, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, one thing I've seen in my practice, because I see a lot of teachers, is that, and this is a continuation of conversation of comments that were made earlier, is that when a child gets into trouble in school, and I'm thinking of examples of some of the poorer districts in New Bedford, which Rick would be familiar with coming from Dartmouth, that it's always the teacher's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't about parents of higher economic groups. This is actually parents in the lowest. There's an assumption that if my child gets in trouble or my child comes home and is unhappy with what's going on in the classroom, it's certainly not my child's fault. It's the teacher's fault. And it's remarkable how often the teachers are unsupported by the parents mm-hmm. when they're trying to address an issue that the child's mm-hmm. having at school. So this isn't even a socioeconomic
right.
issue.
No, it becomes an adversarial a problem between parent and teacher. That seems to be the atmosphere. We're yeah. going to fight. And if you don't fight to the point of really being aggressive, then and defend your child no matter what they did, when you step back and look at that, that's the way you can raise a psychopath.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
I mean, surely in the poorer families where there's either a single parent, mm-hmm. or both parents have jobs, there's less money, there's less time, there's less energy to be paving the way and snow plowing for your child. But that doesn't mean you won't do it if given the opportunity.
Yeah. Right. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Rick, thanks for that. That was a good question. Thanks for calling. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Hearing you say that about the teachers and not feeling supported by parents, I was just thinking back to a teacher that my daughter had many years ago who I loved her. And I love that she, you know, we remember when the Spice Girls were popular and my daughter would pull like her pants down around her hips. And she was tall anyway. And I think she was in third grade. And her teacher started like safety pinning her shirts to her pants. Now, I thought that was brilliant. I was like, oh, that's a brilliant idea. But I was like, you totally have my permission to do whatever you need to keep those pants up. But a lot of parents wouldn't have that reaction, would they?
Not at all.
Rick raised the question of money, too. And that's another factor in all of this. You know, it costs much more to raise a child now, in part because of all the lessons, the time that gets structured for the children, more than any other generation did before. That goes across the board. So that when you get to my age, I feel it necessary to support my daughter, my adult daughter, because I can see that on two incomes, they have trouble because things are just so expensive. And the other thing is that we're at a generation shifting time. We always are. When I grew up, I had an 80% chance of doing better than my parents economically. I was born in the mid-40s. By the 70s, by 1970, that dropped to a 60% chance. And after 1980, up until now, and that's all you can really count is 80 being the mm-hmm. last interval that you could count, it's like 50-50. Mm-hmm. So you have an even chance, if not of earning a little bit more or earning much less. There's a big change in our society, I think, because of this.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is you look at parents co-signing loans and mm-hmm. the outstanding student loan, here's a good statistic. Last year, $1.5 trillion. Wow. And how many parents have I met that are on Social Security still trying to pay off their kids' students' loans mm-hmm. because of the struggle they're having? They've got, even with two incomes, they're trying to raise their own family, and there's a student loan hovering behind them, so the parents step in. But look at that. That's way out of proportion. And that didn't occur decades ago.
No, we didn't have that kind of debt, no, for sure. but that also kind of goes back to the, we need to get the scholarships, you know, because college is expensive. And if you don't have the money, I mean, it really adds the pressure and anxiety. I think, don't we feel anxiety on all ends? I mean, the parents, the kids, there's a lot of anxiety around all of this.
Absolutely. Sure. I think the anxiety is really behind this for every parent's good intention. When you hear about kids getting out of school and being offered six figures right out of an Ivy, that's security. Mm-hmm. That's what I want for my child. Or even in the sports, if they could make it through the statistics of how many people really become pro athletes, very few. But the dream is there. So you push to get that. And it's just, I want that for my kid. I mm-hmm. want them to be okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about parenting this morning. In studio with us is social worker Ann Gagan, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Janet is calling from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi, you're having phone troubles.
Uh-oh, okay, we'll look into that.
Yeah, well, the man said he would. Listen, I have to tell you my experience as a young person. I was 17, And I had an opportunity to get a grant from the American Cancer Society to learn cytology. I was 17. I had not graduated from high school yet. I had to go up to Boston and meet at the Deaconess, the Massachusetts president of the American Cancer Society. Nobody told me how to do it, and I did it, and I had to explain why I was interested. I then started immediately to learn cytology. I had to come back to the island to graduate high school. Also, I had to learn how to live in Boston, which was different from the vineyard. And I somehow managed to do it, and I don't understand why kids can't do that now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a different time, I agree.
Yeah.
But it was a whole change of experience for me, and somehow I managed to cope with it. And I did read that book that the man just referred to, you know,
the orchid
about
one.
The two different types of children.
Yeah.
But what has happened to kids these days?
They're useless.
I think we have a lot of people asking that question. But
every generation does,
actually. It's true. I know. I think about that. I think, like, you know, some of the things we're saying, I would hear my grandmother
and
say.
And the music they listen to.
Music,
oh, my God.
I think I listened to the Beatles, and my father said something like, no wonder there's so many degenerates around. You know, the Beatles, right? Janet, thanks for the call and sharing your experience. And, you know, we should say there are also some really great kids, a lot of great kids who are very independent, and it makes you so hopeful for the future. I mean, we've had some of them on the program here from the different high schools here talking about, you know, some of the, you know, gun control and, you know, the shootings and just humanities. And I'm so impressed by some of these kids that we don't really get to hear a lot about. You know, they're kind of quietly doing their good work. And so we don't want to forget that there's also a lot of kids that are well-adjusted and doing well.
Despite their parents.
Yeah,
exactly.
Maybe, yeah, exactly.
That's right.
And one of the other things, too, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of us, you know, they tend to be judgmental here in this society.
Oh, sure.
And
newsflash.
Yeah, and I think this was, I don't know where you found this, Mark, but this was somebody, I don't know if it was an op-ed, but somebody, Rose from Seattle, she wrote, before getting all judgmental, please remember that some kids struggle with invisible neurological differences and require more hand-holding than their age mates. People aren't always going to discuss their kids' challenges to you, so it's worth bearing in mind that there may be more to the story than you know. Right. So true, right?
Absolutely. Right. So, you know, don't jump to judgment when you see the snowplow parent acting.
Right, and in the world of learning disabilities, there are so many thousands of great examples of this. You know, we have schools, for example, the Hamilton School in Providence, which is part of Wheeler, which does a spectacular job at helping kids with language-based learning disabilities learn how to learn effectively so that when they're finished with eighth grade, which is when the Hamilton School ends, they can typically go on to regular high schools, and they now have new strategies on how to learn. Well, Hamilton School is very expensive. I mean, it's, I don't know what it costs now, but I'm guessing it's certainly at least $25,000 a year for elementary school grades.
Wow, yeah.
How many people can afford that? Not a lot of scholarship money available. If you can afford to hire tutors who are trained in some of the LD, you know, methods to assist your kids, it can make a huge difference.
Yeah.
But not so many people can afford to do that. So certainly parents who are able to give their children with learning disabilities or ADHD or whatever, what have you, a boost. We certainly can't criticize them for that.
For trying. Sure. Well, also too, I just want to put a plug in there for the special needs teachers, because they are amazing. I mean, I'm sure there's some that may not be, but for the most part, they're amazing, and they really know the ins and outs. You know, when you're coming through their classroom with your child, they know a lot of the resources that are out there, and, you know, are very. I found, you know, when my daughter went through the SPED programs, they were so great at, all right, let's try this method or that method. Doesn't work? Let's make up our own. See what works, you know. So they're very flexible at really trying to help these kids learn the best they can.
Yeah.
So don't forget about that. So let's turn to some thoughts then now maybe about how not to be a snowplow parent. As I was saying, because, you know, there's no playbook. It can be confusing. You know, where do you draw the lines in some of the things? What's helping them become, independent adults, and what's maybe standing in their way of that? So some thoughts on what we should be doing.
We're about to be a little bit hypocritical of everything we've said before, because we have some advice, actually.
Exactly.
That makes some sense. There's several things that you can do. And it, really, they all mount up to being mindful about what you're saying and acting, and really judging, making a judgment on yourself without criticism, but at least looking at the motivations. So that one of the first is to empathize with your child when they're facing a crisis of some sort, rather than advise. Mm-hmm. That means so much to see the situation from the child's point of view. And it's so important to do that because you want to reinforce how the child sees things and give them, you're giving them a message of they have competency in assessing the world. And if you come in with advice right away, you've robbed them of some developing better competency in seeing the world and seeing options of how to do things. So you don't want to it come down as a solution focused, but more you want to take actually more of the female approach as opposed to the male approach, which is always solution focused. That is really one step that makes sense. And then ask the kids what they want to do. What do they imply? What do they? How do they want to handle this? And they might say, "I don't know," which would be a pretty typical
standard answer. Yeah. So at that point, say, "Well, here are some. What are the options we could do? X, Y, or Z."
Exactly. Yeah. Don't let them get away with that. You know, that's a dodge, obviously. Mm-hmm. You want to help them become the decider themselves among the options. You might, you know, work with them to develop the options, discuss with them, but don't write them out yourself, develop them. You want to hold back your impulse. Your first impulse is to fix and to make better and to make
do it, for.
Do for it. Yeah, make the pain go away, avoid the pain. That's your first impulse. And of course, that's natural. And try to just sort of observe that and hold it back for a little bit so you can come up with some other ways of intervening that are more suitable to child growth than child stagnation.
All right, I'm going to put in a tough one right here when you say this because I'm thinking of an example I know where a child says, I'm sick, I can't go to school today. I can't go to school. And the underlying problem, not that the child is sick, is that they're being bullied. Mm-hmm. And then when, you know, mom finds out that there's bullying going on, I'm going to call, no, don't call the school. You'll make it worse. No, don't do that. Mm-hmm. There you've got the child's like, I don't want you to do anything, but you can't allow the bullying to go on. What's that conversation like?
Well, I think, from this advice to apply it, is talk with the child. What options do we have here?
What can we do?
Yeah, what can we do?
I could stay home and watch TV.
That's not an option. That's not an option that works for anybody. Right. Let's put our heads together and see what we can do to lessen this, to ameliorate it, to, you're being bullied because of somebody else being upset generally. And let's try to understand it. I think it makes sense to try to understand why somebody's attacking you. It's usually because of their own insecurities. It's just about always because of their own insecurities.
It did work out well, by the way. Just so you know.
Okay,
I think
good.
That was about what happened.
Another example, though, that's related to that is the child who has a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
And who has trouble going to school because of anxiety.
Right.
So there's not really an external force like a bullying child at school. And I've seen parents, I've had several in my practice, I'm a child psychiatrist as well, and seen a lot of kids who are homeschooled mm-hmm. for several years because they had what used to be called school anxiety or school phobia. And I think that for the vast majority of these children, it's really a disservice mm-hmm. because you're removing them from an environment in which they're learning social skills or allowing, getting treatment for their anxiety so they can then go to school and overcome the anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing I think that we have to allow our kids to make mistakes and fail.
Yeah.
Actually
exactly.
fail. Mm-hmm. Actually not do it right. Not mm-hmm. actually not. And that is where the parental anxiety comes in. It's like I can't allow that to happen. Well, life is full of successes and failures and joys and sorrows. eliminating the spectrum of life and all the feelings and all the opportunities really narrows down the child's tools
sure.
for dealing with what happens on the school in school and in college and in life.
Mm.
So I think a parent has to learn how to feel that failure belongs to them. That's not my failure.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to set, and that's a hard one for parents, boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Boundaries.
Sure. Yeah. And learn from, you know, yeah. And there are options. You know, what's the take-home message from this failure? How can you, what would you do differently now knowing that you failed? What would you do differently a week ago?
Mm-hmm. You know, also, too, I'm thinking when you talk about failures, I mean, as parents, we also fail sometimes.
Oh.
And I think being able to talk about that, you know, I'm sorry, I was wrong about whatever the argument you might have with your mm-hmm. child is. I mean, that kind of
modeling
exactly.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And then not beating yourself up over some mistake you made in one of your parenting decisions, because we all make some bad mistakes along the way, and it doesn't really help to beat you. Just learn from it, right? Don't beat yourself up over it, because then you go, oh my gosh, what trauma have I caused my child, right? When you do something like that.
Or if you do feel bad about yourself, take that as a cue to learn yourself what to do different the next time.
Right. You know what? It strikes me in all of this, as Mark's talking, it takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for many parents, everything with the child is so highly scheduled
yeah.
that there's no time when they're moving from this activity to find out really what's happening with them.
You're right.
And it's much more convenient to just go in and take care of it, talk to the coach or talk to the teacher instead of talking to the child.
Mm-hmm.
And everything needs to slow down.
Yeah. Isn't it funny, too? Often when I'm seeing an adolescent or a middle school child, it's actually harder to find time in their schedule to come in and see me
oh, wow.
than it is to find time in my schedule to see them.
Oh,
that seems weird to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that
yeah.
should never. A child should never have a busier schedule than the physician that they're trying to go see.
Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Exactly. And then just one of the other things when you were talking, Mark, something popped in my head was the, you know, what you say, words matter.
Yeah.
How you frame these conversations, you know, you want to be careful, because I think we can all think of instances in our childhood that we still remember where, you know, somebody said something, you know, a parent, a grandparent, something that just really stung and stuck with you. So we want to think about what words we use.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, your kids are always looking, reading your facial expressions and your tone of voice. They're like sponges. And mm-hmm. younger, the more sponge they are.
Yeah.
Again, just be mindful and enjoy the process. Hopefully you can feel the joy of watching a child develop. It's
yeah,
it's an amazing thing.
And I should say, for the many other grandparents out there raising grandchildren, you get a second chance at this, right?
Sure.
You get to do it all over again.
Yeah.
And I think you do it a lot differently the second time than you do it the first time. Maybe we've learned some lessons from you. Choose your battles this time around, I think. Yeah. And
there is something to be said about being older and
right.
more mature. You don't have the sense of yourself so much at stake all the time. You do say when you're in a teenage year, certainly, or your 20s,
yeah.
You have a perspective.
Yeah. So just kind of wrapping up in the last minute or so, we have the snowplow parenting thing. It's not maybe as common as we think. Like, you know, we talked about it. I mean, it's happening, but how common do we think it really is? Do we know?
I think it's in the cultural atmosphere.
Yeah.
As a trend,
right.
And I think, as you said when we began, Mindy, that this is the worst example, and Mark said it's brought it to the surface. But it's a trend, and mm-hmm. if we don't examine these trends, then we are highly influenced by them.
Mm. Right. The trend is not to pay $500,000 to bribe somebody so your child gets into a school that they have no good reason to be at. But the trend is definitely to insulate your child from inconvenience, from frustration. And I think parents would do themselves and their child a great service to be more mindful of how that's not always the best way to parent.
All sure. Right. We'll leave it there.
You can start today, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, and social worker Ann Gagan. Thank you all. See you next month.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.